That's a good practice if you just want to sort of release energy, is to do the ah practice where you just go, ah. And just settling into your body. How are you feeling right now? What is the energy in your body like? And just feeling the breath in the body. Notice how the body moves with the breath. And then let your attention just move through, either from head to toe or toe to head. Through the body, just finding points of tension or sensation, just releasing any tightness if you can. Anything that doesn't want to be released, just see if you can accept it, just allow it to be there, not fighting with it. Letting your shoulders relax, softening the belly, see if you can feel your whole body as a single object. And this body, this is a whole realm of sensation. All kinds of sensations throughout the body. When we start to tune in, we realize it's not a single thing. Oh, if you're in a space where there is some sound, some noise, or background sounds, just taking a few moments to listen, practicing mindful listening, not naming the sounds, just noticing all the sounds in your environment. And then checking in with how you're feeling on the more emotional level or just mood. You might find it easy to just say how you're feeling if someone asked you. But the further question is, how do you know that? What are the markers? What are the elements of your experience that tell you what you're feeling? So with this practice, we suggest that you can get at this question through the body. So noticing how mood or emotions manifest in the body. The first and perhaps most obvious place to start with this examination is in the chest and the belly, the torso. We associate emotions with those parts of the body. We talk about having our heart open or our heart broken. Talk about butterflies in the stomach when we're talking about anxiety or nervousness. Or a hole in the gut. And there's grief or sadness. So this is a really helpful way to start this kind of examination and this kind of bring this kind of mindfulness into our lives. To make it a regular practice, both in meditation and outside of meditation, to notice what you're feeling in these parts of the body, the chest and belly. And you may even notice a connection to your thoughts or your kind of attitude, present moment attitude. When you're feeling a certain way, you have certain kind of thoughts. That way we start to see the conditioned nature of our thinking. That as much as we claim to be rational or logical, that oftentimes our thoughts themselves are just conditioned by our mood. As we become more attuned to feeling, we'll see that the manifestations are not just in the chest and belly, but really can be almost anywhere in the body. The shoulders, the arms, running up and down the back, the face, certainly. Feels, emotions, tears themselves are expressions of feelings. So this then helps us to attune and take care, potentially take care of our mood and what we might need in a particular moment when we become more aware of what we're feeling, less driven by the feelings, but more able to just allow them to be there without them generating words or actions that might be unhelpful. Always try to keep the breath in mind as you tune in to feelings. The breath will help you to stay grounded, not to get swept away and lost in the feelings. So breathing with feelings can become your practice, or at least a part of your practice, one element. Breathing with feelings. For addicts, but perhaps for anyone, to do this work is challenging, takes some courage and definitely some care. You find yourself getting triggered or overwhelmed, then just come back to the simplicity of mindfulness. Just feeling your body, feeling your breath. Letting go of the focus on mood and emotion. All right. So you might be wondering why that was such a strange guided meditation. Welcome to my world, as they say. You know, we've been, for those who are new, these last now 10 months, we've been working with my book, One Breath at a Time, my first book. And we're in step six, and a lot of the focus on step six is feeling feelings. And this is really, for me, like a key element of practice. And I describe, I'm going to talk a little bit about this moment of sort of starting to learn this practice, start to think about it as a practice. It's got its challenges for addicts. Certainly one of the motivations behind our addiction is our problems with emotions, or either our inability to manage them, or and our wish to suppress them or to create good ones, and then becoming numb to feelings, and all of that is complicated, particularly if there's trauma involved in our history, because it's not so easy to just feel your feelings if they come out of that kind of really disruptive experience. And nonetheless, it seems that in order to really come into what we could call recovery, as opposed to sobriety or just being clean, some healthy integration of our feelings and some degree of becoming friends with our emotional life is really at the heart of that, right? It's all the rest is there's a lot of work we do around recovery, but if we never can get comfortable in our own skin, it's going to be really hard to sustain, and it's going to be really just painful. I'm going to go to this section of the book called Feeling Feelings 2. And so on page 146, if you're interested in it. And much of this section is written in this sort of narrative way that I used in the book, where I'm sort of describing scenes of being on a retreat. But the opening paragraph, I actually want to start here, where I say that my own experience with learning how to feel began on the three-month retreat. And this is a three-month retreat I took in 1981, which kind of was a marker. Up to then, I had worked with the formal practices my teachers had offered, following the breath, noting thoughts, sounds, and sensations, and watching my experience arise and pass away moment to moment. Now I would have to learn a whole new approach to meditation. So I glanced at that this morning and thought, I don't want to skip over this little paragraph. Because I don't want to suggest that what I am offering here in terms of working with feelings is a superior practice, or one that should be used instead of other practices. I think that my experience with meditation is that different moments call for different tools. It's the proverbial toolbox, and that to become I'm not sure how to describe, I don't want to say a good meditator. It's not a good, not a useful term. But to become a sort of mature meditator, shall we say, One is, I think, best served by learning a variety of practices and becoming adept at responding to given moments with different tools, kind of developing somewhat of an intuition and just experience to know, oh, when I'm feeling this way, it's really helpful if I do this. And so there's this, you know, palette that we draw from, this range of tools. And so I list some of them here, following the breath, obviously a very basic tool of meditation, but one that's just never goes out of fashion. You know, it's just forever useful. And as I was talking about in the guided meditation, can also be integrated into other forms of mindfulness, as when working with the feelings, when we breathe with the feeling, and sort of having the breath there as kind of a supportive element works when we're doing loving kindness practice. Feeling the breath with the loving kindness is you know, really an effective tool. So the breath is really just such a wonderful thing to integrate. Then I mentioned noting thoughts, sounds, and sensations. So this practice, I don't teach much in a formal way, but at this time, which was 1981, that I was, when I first, 1980-81, I learned Vipassana meditation. What was particularly emphasized in those days was this practice that comes out of the Burmese Buddhist tradition, and particularly was known through Mahasi Sayadaw, a very famous 20th century Burmese Buddhist teacher. I'll actually put his name in the chat here, Mahasi. So, Mahasi Sayadaw. So Mahasi emphasized a practice whereby there's almost a continual mental noting of whatever you're experiencing. So you sit down and it's like in, out, in, out. Then you have a thought. So you might just note thinking. You realize you're thinking. And then you come back to the breath, in, out. So you're noting the breath as well, right? Then, you know, if you're on a retreat or you're trying to be mindful, if you're walking, then if you're doing mindful walking, you're noting lifting, moving, placing, lifting, moving, placing, and you're continuously noting. You hear a sound, you note hearing, you know, then if you're reaching for a glass of water, reaching, touching, lifting, moving, drinking. So it's this meticulous form of noting practice, which is what was really being taught at the time I was on this retreat. It was suggested that we just sort of, one way to approach the retreat was to be continuously noting every subtle movement and action and mental, you know, manifestation. It's a really interesting practice and very educational. And what it particularly does, I think, is points to the type of attention that mindfulness is asking of us. This just to, not to just be like, oh yeah, I'm here, I'm sitting here, I'm breathing, I'm hanging out, but to really and then what can arise out of that potentially is tremendous concentration and focus, because there, you know, you're paying such close attention. And it's, you know, as you can sort of tell, I mean, if you're imagining this now, it can also become sort of like an OCD experience. Like you're just like almost like obsessive kind of paying attention. And, you know, I had my concerns about some of the people on that retreat that they were, anyway, that, so what happened for me, I'll talk about my own experience instead of projecting onto others. What happened for me is that this became, instead of being a helpful tool as it was at first, it became a battle. It became this battle between me and noting, you know, and one in which I was losing because I couldn't, I wasn't getting settled through it. It was like the noting was just stirring things up even more. And oftentimes the noting would then trigger a judgment, a self-judgment. Oh, there I go again. I'm thinking again. And I would start to get into, you know, it's recommended that you, that when you're noting thoughts, that you start to note different types of thoughts. So then you're sort of noting that you're always fantasizing, or you're always, you know, thinking in certain ways. Always is an exaggeration, but it seems that way, right? That there's these repetitive types of thoughts. And instead of it sort of a letting go happening, what happened for me was that there was more clinging, but clinging to a negative state, like this isn't working. And so at a certain point, I really let go of that. excuse me. Nonetheless, I think it's a worthwhile practice to try, to experiment with. You know, my experience isn't necessarily going to be your experience. And if you're interested in learning more about Mahasi's practice, and actually a really great book, Jack Kornfield's first book, which is now called Living Dharma. It was originally called Living Buddhist Masters. So he interviewed, back in the 70s, he interviewed a bunch of the living masters in Southeast Asia. And Mahasi Sayadaw was one of them. So, and Mahasi in that book describes just what I'm telling you, like how to note, how to pay attention in this way. Very interesting. Nonetheless, going back to this retreat experience, this, you know, I found at a certain point this wasn't working for me so well, but I don't so much feel like reading this section of the book, but I want to tell you sort of the story of this, these experiences, which is, so I'm on retreat. I've been sitting for a couple of weeks. It's going to be 3 months, which is kind of scaring the hell out of me. It sort of still does, actually. I have not sat another 3 month retreat since then. So I think I was a bit traumatized by it. I was not sober. This is fall of 1981. I got sober in June of 1985. But nonetheless, I certainly wasn't drinking or taking drugs on the retreat. I was very kind of innocent in that way, because apparently there were people who did things like that, but I was a good boy. But the, you know, I'm sitting the retreat, and I know many of you have been on retreats, so you know there's kind of a settling in the process. Now, when it's a three-month retreat, there's sort of a, it's almost like the settling in adjusts to the length of retreat. If you're going on a 5-day retreat, it takes you like 2 days to settle in. If you're going on a 10-day retreat, it takes you like 4 days to settle in. If you're going on a month-long retreat, it takes you like a week to settle in. If you're going on a 3-month retreat, it takes you like a month to settle in. So it's all relative, shall we say. I'd been sitting for a couple of weeks and, you know, I was sort of settling, but there was this kind of fogginess. And it wasn't just sleepiness, but it was sort of like, I just didn't feel like I was fully present. So each morning, one of the teachers, and there was on a retreat this long, when there was 100 or 100 people on it, there were many teachers, but and they would alternate giving meditation instruction. And Joseph Goldstein was one of them, and Jack Kornfield, one of the others. And so that this particular morning, Joseph had given the meditation instruction. And after the instruction, I went up to say, to ask him a question, which, you know, on these retreats, again, if people have been on retreats, you know, you meet with the teacher every few days. The rest of the time, you're kind of on your own. So if you have sort of a pressing question, it can be difficult to like get it answered. But there he was. And so I kind of rush up to the dais where he's getting ready to walk off. And I say to him, you know, I'm settling. Well, I have this dialogue here. I'm settling in okay. I mean, everything's going fine, but there's a kind of dullness. And he just like turns to me, looks at me and says, "Don't be afraid to feel." And then he walks away. Now, Joseph doesn't know me at that point. I've sat, this is my second retreat with him. I've been in some interviews with him, but, you know, I'm just a face in the crowd. So I'm a little taken aback by this comment. Don't be afraid to feel. Just, you know, just turn to me like, "Oh, don't be afraid to feel. See you later." Like, what? I'm like, what? What? Who? Me? How do you? What are you talking about? And, you know, my first reaction is like, what? How can you say that? Like, I'm a very emotional person. I'm depressed all the time. Like, doesn't that show how in tune with my feelings I am? But, you know, I take it as a kind of challenge. What's he mean? You know, what am I not feeling? And as I say here, you know, I feelings have always been my problem, feeling too much. So, you know, I think this can't be right, you know. But so I do walking meditation and I start to try to tune into what am I feeling? I just start asking myself, what am I feeling? And so that goes on, but it's just a few days later, I'm pretty sure in the book, I say it's 2 weeks later. So that might be right. I had a better memory when I wrote this book than I do now. And it was not as far in the past. So I'm in a one-on-one interview with Jack Kornfield. So this is a time when, you know, where you meet with the teacher privately and it's like 15 or 20 minutes you get to be with them. And I say to him, when I do the noting, it just turns into more judging. So I'm talking about the noting practice, right? You know, I say, I can't seem to get it. And Jack looks at me and says, "Your practice is to feel." And I'm like, really now I'm confused. I'm like, have these guys been talking about me? Like, that, you know, there's 100 people on this retreat. Like, they don't know me from Adam or Eve. You know, I mean, what is going on, you know? And so he takes me through a little practice then where he sort of asks me to see what I'm feeling in the middle of my chest and, you know, points to that. And, you know, he says, you know, your feelings may show up in your middle of your chest or they may show up other places. Just keep paying attention to where in your body you can feel your feelings. So as I describe, you know, this then I start to really pay attention to this. And it starts to become not just something I'm paying attention to when I'm walking, but when I'm sitting. And, you know, because I'm on a long retreat, my mind is really, really gets clear, and you get into this very spacious quality anyway. So it's very powerful no matter what you're doing. You know, I mean, you sit in a silent retreat for months and stuff happens. But because I'm focused in this particular way, it's starting to be like the way, if I can try to describe it, it's like I'm leading now with the front of my body. When I'm meditating, it's not that I'm physically leaning forward, but it does feel as if somehow there's this opening and like leaning forward into the what I'm feeling. And it's instead of being a sense of resistance or even inquiry, like what am I feeling, it becomes a practice of like opening, like bring it on. Let me just feel, just let it wash through me. And because it's in that, again, intensive environment, there's so much clarity. Things don't tend to get stuck, right? They just tend to kind of wash through. And I start to just be able to sit with it. It's just like feeling, waves of feeling. And they stop being really emotions as much as just energies. And they become concentration objects too. And just like we can pay attention to the flow of sensations in the body, you can start to pay attention to the flow of emotions, just as energy's passing through. So that really, really changed how I meditate. And it's never been the same since then, which is why, you know, in this chapter in the book, there are three sections called feeling feelings, you know. And the last one, I think, is interesting as well. We'll get to it at some point. But it's, as a teacher, it's always been a challenge for me to figure out how to pass this on in a helpful way. I don't know, first of all, that everybody needs to practice in this way, or that, you know, that this is the right thing that I should teach. But it's also such a sort of ephemeral thing to try to offer to people. It's like, well, feelings, but they're in your body. So they're not sensations, but they're not sensations. And it's part of your mood, but what is a mood after all? And it's really like a tricky thing to talk about. You know, I go to the suttas, to the early Buddhist teachings. Very difficult to find anything that correlates with what we're talking about here. If you look at the four foundations of mindfulness, and maybe we should do that since I'm bringing this up in the coming weeks. It's hard to pinpoint a place where the Buddha is actually talking about what we in our culture call emotions. There's the first foundation is just body. Second foundation is vedana, which is an untranslatable word. We translate it as feeling, but it's not emotions. It's the initial impact, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, of every sense or mental experience. Well, that's not an emotion. That's just like a sort of trigger. Okay, so then the third foundation of mindfulness, translated as mind states, and we're like, well, is that thoughts? Well, it's, is the mind concentrated? Is the mind spacious? You know, is the mind, oh, mind states, okay. Not quite emotions, but there's an element I mean, we can see feeling has an element of emotions, body has an element of emotions, mind states have an element of emotions, but not one of them sort of encapsulates what our, again, what our culture, what in our language would be an emotion. And then the fourth foundation, even more difficult to translate, as dharmas or phenomena, but it's, you know, seems to be a bunch of Buddhist lists, the four foundations of mindfulness. Well, sorry, that's of course not the four foundations, the five hindrances, the seven factors of awakening, the four noble truths, the five aggregates. Again, not emotions. So, okay, hard to pin down. I don't know if I'm being particularly useful or helpful this morning, but you know, I like to kind of open up these areas of inquiry. I don't think it's that helpful for me to give answers that I don't 100% believe. I could, and I know there are teachers who do that. We'll just tell you this is what it is. Maybe you should go to them. They might be more helpful. But in any case, coming back to this root practice, I think for particularly for people in recovery, learning to work with these energies in a mindful way is invaluable. Whether it's like in the suttas, whether I can communicate it or not, you know, you have to explore it for yourself. And as I say, carefully, because again, if you have a history of trauma, these are the places where you can really get triggered. And at the same time, if you have a history of trauma, this is how it can get healed. If you can integrate those feelings, it just has to be done very carefully. And that's best done probably one-on-one with a therapist. But you can, I mean, you know, you can, I think, work around the edges and carefully. On your own and in this kind of setting. So I've rambled on. Thank you, Vil. Don't confuse it with another book called The Living Dharma by Sri Dharma Prabhupada. He's not a very liberal and open person. Okay. So Living Dharma is by Jack Kornfield. I will put in his name. So, oh yeah, thank you, Sanjeev, about EMDR, which I don't like pretty much zilch about, but I have also heard that's great for working with trauma. So thank you. If anybody wants to speak out loud now, we have a few minutes and you're welcome to unmute or raise your hand fake sense, the electronical sense. Anybody?
I'll raise my real hand.
Debbie, I'm glad you raised your hand because I wanted to just mention, would you just send me an email? I want to talk to you about something, but go ahead.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Thank you.
I just really, really appreciated the meditation this morning. I think I, like yourself, I resonated a bit with sometimes noting my thoughts. It can take me into, keep me in that cognitive part of the brain. Yeah. And the mindfulness of the feelings and sensations in my body just allows me to rest into that, what's underneath. And that's been a huge part of the meditative practice and also my journey in the 12-step program. Let's get what's underneath. Yeah. And I'm grateful today because as I was in this process, I noticed that I'm like on the outer edges of the eddy of which I've been caught in. For a while, you know, I've been caught in an eddy in my life, and I fell off the raft in the middle of the eddy, you know. I can be rest in the center of the storm where it's peace and calm, or I can be caught in the vortex of an eddy, which will be pulling and dragging me down. So to be able to rest in the feelings and realize, oh, this too is impermanent.
Yeah.
I'm back on the edges. I'm back resting on this raft of breath, of mindfulness, of allowing, and it's okay. It's okay. And to have that, to be able to just kind of rest in that. And so that's what you offered me today, really enriching the process that I'm in and realizing that what I've been through the last few weeks, maybe have, you know, some things have been turbulent, but as long as I stay connected with Sangha, with group, with practice, and with wise teachings such as that you offer, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
You need to keep breathing. Keep
That's
feeling.
Great.
Okay. So thank you for offering the time to share that.
Yeah. Thanks, Debbie. That's really great. And a couple things you said, I want to really emphasize too, that continuing to look underneath, look what's beneath and what's beneath. I think really a critical piece. And also, as you said, remembering that it's impermanent. So we're not just meditating in the midst of swirling emotions that are just like gonna, as you say, sort of pull us under, but that rather, okay, it's an energy that's, if it's energy, then it has to be impermanent. It's moving. So we know it's going to change. And that's our life raft, right? Is like, it's going to change. I'll be okay. Just it's freaky right now, but I don't have to run away or do anything, you know, destructive to get away from it, because it'll go away on its own. Thank you. So there's a couple of hands up, which is great. Monica.
Hi.
Hi.
I loved, in fact, I got some aha moments also from this talk. So, one thing that has really occurred to me that often my thought process is stuff I am judging, you know, the thoughts, you know, so it's judging thoughts.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really great aha moment. I also have some thoughts sometimes that pop up about people that are unresolved. But somewhere in my recovery, I heard that thing about thoughts are not things.
Yeah.
It's hard to put into practice, but I'm working on it because why I'm here. But I mean, this is an amazing tool that I wish everybody would adopt, you know, as far, because, you know, I have a tendency, I'm a good, you know, I'm an addict through and through, and I have a tendency to get caught in obsessive thoughts.
Yeah.
I have to really work at that. And this has been an amazing tool. And it's also great to see, you know, to really talk, we're talking about impermanence. So yeah. Impermanence, thoughts are impermanence, lots of things, you know, life is impermanent. Anyway, thank you so much. Really grateful.
Thank you. Yeah. This is your point about, you know, addicts and really, you know, needing something to, some way to hold their thoughts and to let go of their thoughts. I think it's certainly one of the reasons why I do this work and why I've always thought it was valuable. And it's one of the ways that when I'm introducing this to, like, in a treatment center or something, it's like, yeah, some way of calming the thoughts and holding the thoughts and reflecting in the thoughts and seeing them for what they are, you know, feelings aren't facts and thoughts aren't facts. They're just, and pointing out to people, like, you can think something one day and the next day you can think just the opposite. So they're not, how can they be true? You know, how can they have some absolute validity to them? So yeah, really critical thing that observing thoughts, right? The very idea, oh, noticing, oh, that was a thought. What was that? Oh, I was just thinking this. Well, that's a revolutionary action to do that, to question that. And it's really the what is so transformative in this practice. So one more, Gail, hi, nice to see you.
Hi, thank you, Kevin. I have your book, and maybe this is a plug for your book, but January 19th is called Counting Breaths.
Uh-huh.
That's what we were talking about today. And it ends with counting breaths is mostly for times when you're especially agitated or restless. And so I added what you said today about feeling my feelings turns out to be easier, an easier, more natural practice for me than noting thoughts or watching my breath. So I like that you gave me something in addition to, not necessarily an alternative, because the today's reading in your daily reflection is about when I'm especially agitated and restless, which is where I usually start.
Right.
And, you know, as I go through it, somewhere around 30 or 40 minutes in, then I start to feel myself really settle. And I have ringing in my ears. And the interesting thing is when I start to settle, the ringing just kind of comes down about 3 or 4 decibels. And it just sort of quiets out, which is the most amazing realization that it's like, oh, wow. Anyway, so I guess a book about you. So it's a great book. I get to read it every morning. It gives me something to read and think about. And if you don't have it, this is a plug for your book. I suggest you get it. Thank you for the book.
Thank you. Just a total plug. And you know, if people keep buying it, I'll be able to just retire and stop doing all this nonsense. It'd be great. But thank you, Gail, and please feel free to rewrite or add anything to that book. It's, you know, it was my effort, but everything is incomplete. They say that James Joyce used to go around to bookstores and pull his books off the shelves and to make marks and scratch lines out and rewrite lines. So if James Joyce wasn't satisfied with his writing, I can be. Yeah, and I think you're reinforcing my point also that this is a collection of tools to be used. And just as you're saying, not just like, oh, today I'm going to do this practice, tomorrow I'm going to do that practice, but rather that in the course of a period of meditation, you might use several different tools. And you want to be very intentional with that, not just like, oh, I'm sick of this, I think I'll do that. Oh, what, I think I'll try that other thing that they were talking, but rather, oh, right now, like I did some breath counting this morning in my early morning sit. Just as you, like I do count the breath, go through like 1 to 10 a couple of times just to kind of settle. And then I can move into a more, for me, more organic practice of sitting with feeling, with breath, with body. And so, that's look at you. I had my copy spiral bound with the table of contents added in the beginning. Whoa, look at you. Wow. Yeah. So I did, for those who haven't noticed that, because there are so many different topics in the book, if I put in a table of contents, it would have added like 20 pages. So that people can see what all the topics are, I put them on a web page on my website. And the URL is in the preface of the book. I'm glad to know somebody's utilizing that. You know, sometimes I put stuff up there and I think nobody's ever going to care. But thank you. Thanks, Gail.
It allows me to turn it flat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Why I liked spiral binding.
That was one of my concerns about this book, because it's so long that you open it, and it's going to break the spine, and it's going to wear out. And so then you're going to have to buy another copy, which, you know, I'll collect more royalties. So it could work out. Anyway, very nice to see everybody. Thank you all for coming. And, you know, yeah, that's one less hour. So what was it? 23 hours. So in 24 hours, we will have, a new president? Is that how that works? Yeah. God willing. You know, talk about impermanence, right? like it just seemed like this would never end. It really did. When we were caught in the middle of this, we kept thinking like Mueller's going to save us, you know, or something's going to, you know, impeachment's going to save us. And, I mean, it really, it just, it's such a, I don't know. It's more than a relief, right? It really feels like some horrible hell realm is coming to an end. And yet I know we're all still a little bit like, yeah, but is it, will it, what about those crazies out there, you know? But yeah, I mean, to see what the plan is, like for the first day, you know, to realize, the day one, things are going to change. The first 10 days, things are going to change, you know? It's going to be better for a while anyway. And it'll get worse again, but maybe we'll be dead by then. You never know. That's the other thing, you know? The world might go on, but we won't have to be there for it forever. You know, you're here for a while. Anyway, another cheery thought. I'm always full of cheerful thoughts for everybody. We're having beautiful weather in Northern California. I'm going to go outside and enjoy it today. You know, stay safe. It's really, really hard to keep this up, but we'll make it. And, you know, really seriously, I want you all to be safe and to see you when this all passes and maybe give you hugs somewhere, sometime. So, peace.